This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, welcome to Natural Life. I'm Kim McCurdy. In this half hour, I will be reading articles from publications like Mother Earth News and Hobby Farms to help us live a little more naturally. Today's feature topics will include a baking article and an article about insects. So let's get started with Mother Earth News. December 2023, January 2024 issue. And this first article is promised as a baking article. It's entitled Warm, Buttery English Muffins. You'll know which side your bread is buttered on when you bake up a batch of this simple breakfast toast. This is by William Rubel. In the mid-19th century, hundreds of vendors known as muffin men plied the streets of London, ringing a bell, announcing still warm bread for sale. Londoners wanted English muffins delivered warm to their doorsteps, a bread so good that thousands of men over the course of nearly 150 years supported their families by selling warm muffins for toasting at home. You too can enjoy freshly made English muffins by following this simple traditional recipe. This bread is called English in the United States to distinguish it from our American-style cake muffins. In England, the bread, known simply as a muffin, hasn't really changed since Hannah Glass published what may be the first recorded muffin recipe in her hugely popular 1747 cookbook, The Art of Cookery Made Plain and Easy. Like pancakes, English muffins are griddle-baked breads made with a standard soft bread dough. Hannah Glass called it light, not enriched with milk or eggs. To make them at home, you can prepare dough using the ingredients in the following recipe from Glass's 1747 book, or by mixing up any recipe for French bread. Note that many modern English muffin recipes include milk, butter, and sugar, and these ingredients will make the bread even softer. You can mix up whatever dough suits your taste. Your homemade version will always have an edge over packaged goods from a grocery store. Think of the following instructions as a single muffin recipe that can produce two different styles of bread. Today, we usually split and toast a cold English muffin and eat the halves separately. But people in Glass's time toasted the muffin immediately after baking before it got cold. They ate the whole muffin by biting into it as a warm, buttery sandwich. The traditional muffin is experienced as crispness when the teeth first bite through the crust, followed by an incredibly soft, buttery loveliness. Here's how Glass explained it in her book. When you eat them, toast them with a fork crisp on both sides. Then with your hand, pull them apart, and they will be like a honeycomb. Lay in as much butter as you intend to use, then clap them together again and set it by the fire. When you think the butter is melted, turn them, that both sides may be buttered alike. But don't touch them with a knife, either to spread or cut them open. If you do, they will be as heavy as lead. Only when they are quite buttered and done, you may cut them across with a knife. Now that I've discovered the original system, I like to eat a couple of Glass's style of muffins immediately as muffin toast and let the rest cool to eat as buttered toast with marmalade and an Eggs Benedict, a toasted muffin topped with Canadian bacon, a poached egg, and hollandaise sauce. The great American jazz singer Ella Fitzgerald recorded a traditional English song about London's muffin men in 1941. Search online for her recording of The Muffin Man for the perfect music to make these muffins by. Traditional recipe for English muffins. If you usually make sandwich bread, you'll find English muffin dough is much wetter and stickier. When working with a sticky bread dough, rub your hands with a little cooking oil or work the dough with wet hands. I dip my hands in a bowl of water at my work area. If you plan to try the historic toasting method, requiring the bread to still be warm from the griddle, then have a couple of clean dish towels handy so you can wrap the muffins as soon as they come off the griddle. I always make this dough in advance and store it, covered, in the refrigerator. Refrigerating the dough will allow you to make just a few muffins in the morning for breakfast or brunch without having to bake off the entire batch. And as with all yeasted doughs, time spent in the refrigerator will develop flavor. Aim to use up all the dough within a few days. You must use plain yeast without enzymes and dough conditioners if you intend to refrigerate the dough, because dough made with conditioned yeast won't rise properly in the fridge. This recipe yields about 10 muffins. Here is the list of ingredients. 3.5 cups of unbleached all-purpose white flour. 1.5 teaspoons of salt. 1.5 teaspoons of yeast. 1.5 cups of warm water, 95 degrees Fahrenheit. Extra flour and cornmeal for dusting. Mixing and rising the dough. 1. In a large mixing bowl, whisk together the flour, salt, and yeast. Add the warm water and mix to form a rough dough. 2. Turn out the dough onto a clean countertop to knead. Have a bowl of water handy so you can keep your hands wet for easier handling of sticky dough. Knead the dough until it's elastic, 2 to 3 minutes. 3. Place dough in a lightly oiled bowl and cover. Either refrigerate to use the following day or let rise in a warm place until doubled. If you use a proofing oven, set it to 85 degrees. 4. When ready to cut the dough, remove it from refrigerator if applicable. Dust a clean work surface with cornmeal. Lightly dust the dough inside the bowl with flour and then turn onto a work surface. Lightly dust the top of the dough with flour. Gently press to degausse, then continue gently flattening the dough with your hands. I think they mean to degasse, maybe. Gently press to degasse. Apologies. Then continue gently flattening the dough with your hands. When the dough is about 1 inch thick, turn it over and continue pressing until it's a half inch thick. A rolling pin is helpful when you rework the dough left over from the first flattening, as it may be too stiff to flatten with your hands. Number 5. Place a shallow bowl containing a small amount of flour at your work area. With a sturdy drinking glass, cut out muffin discs 3 to 4 inches in diameter. Dip the glass rim into the bowl of flour before making each cut. Place dough discs on a platter dusted with cornmeal and cover. Griddle baking. Unless you have a temperature-controlled induction cooktop that'll produce an even temperature across the cooking surface, your challenge will be to keep the griddle hot enough to bake the muffins, but also cool enough they won't color. Cast iron cookware is the best equipment for making English muffins. I also recommend a heat diffuser to put under your griddle or frying pan. In lieu of this, you can place a second cast iron pan under the first to help distribute the heat evenly. An infrared thermometer will help you monitor the surface temperature of the cooking surface, but you can also use your own judgment and learn through trial and error. Although neither of these tools is required, they'll help give you a sense of control over the baking. Number 1, after you've cut the muffin discs, begin heating the griddle and heat diffuser or second cast iron pan, if using, stacked on top of each other on the cooktop. Allow 30 minutes for the griddle's temperature to stabilize at about 325 degrees. Always err on the baking surface being too cool rather than too hot. Your aim is to produce a fully baked muffin that remains pale, and the bread will begin to color when the griddle is above 325 degrees. 2. With a spatula, flip the muffins when they've nearly doubled in height after 4 to 5 minutes. The dough will still be raw in the middle of the muffins. 3. After baking the muffins for a few minutes on the second side, flip them back to the first side. Continue flipping them every few minutes. English muffins are easy to slide around on the cooking surface while they're baking. To bake them as evenly as possible, I like to slide the discs around on the griddle so they're not always in the same spot. If the muffins begin to brown, the griddle is too hot and you should remove the pan from the heat for a short time until it cools down slightly. 4. The muffin will be fully baked in about 20 minutes. A thin wooden skewer inserted into the muffin's waist should come out fairly clean, with only a few small bits of sticky dough clinging to it. If you want to make glasses crispy muffins, proceed immediately to the following instructions. If you want to eat them in the American style, let the muffins cool to room temperature and divide them in half by pushing the tines of a dinner fork into the muffin waist, working the tines around the waist, and then prying the halves apart. Historic muffin toast. Wrap the baked muffins in a towel as soon as you take them off the griddle. To follow Glass's recipe, the muffins must be toasted and buttered while still warm from the first baking to maintain a contrast between the crisp crust and the soft buttered interior. Luckily, muffins can cool surprisingly slowly, so they'll still be about 145 degrees after an hour wrapped in cloth. 1. Toast the muffin on the end of a fork in front of a wood fire, or more practically under a broiler or inside a toaster oven until both sides are brown. The interior temperature will rise above 210 degrees. 2. With your fingers, pry the muffins in half at the waist. Place a good-sized piece of butter inside, close the halves like a sandwich, and then toast in front of a wood fire or inside a 225-degree oven. Flip after a couple of minutes so the butter will melt into both sides. 3. After a few minutes, remove the muffin from the heat. Serve immediately by cutting the muffin in half across the top like a sandwich. William Rubel writes about bread, hearth cooking, and traditional foodways. He's the author of Bread, A Global History, and the founder and director emeritus of Stone Soup magazine. He lives and bakes English muffins in California with his daughter. The next article comes from the same publication. It's entitled Magnificent Monarch Migration. This fall, help out these beautiful butterflies as they make their yearly journey south, by Tom Oder. When most people think about planting a garden, it's probably fair to say they think of putting in spring and summer gardens. After all, fresh, bright green foliage and colorful flowers after dreary gray days of winter are a welcome sight. But this year, consider helping migratory monarch butterflies by showing some love to the autumnal garden. Fall is a critical time for the butterfly known for its striking orange and black wing patterns. It's when the monarch butterfly begins its migration south. The migratory monarch butterfly can be broadly split into two populations, the ones west of the Rocky Mountains and the ones east of it. The eastern monarchs make up the majority of the North American monarch population. Beginning in mid-August and ending in early November, they travel from the northern end of their summer breeding range, from the Canadian provinces of Alberta to Nova Scotia, and from the U.S. upper Midwest to the northeastern states, to their historical overwintering grounds of Oyamel fir forests. These butterflies will settle in the Monarch Butterfly Biosphere Reserve, northwest of Mexico City. It's a long and arduous journey that takes them, in some instances, across three nations, during which they soar as high as 11,000 feet and fly as far as 80 miles a day. Their destination is a place they've never been. A hardy traveler. According to Rebecca Quiñones Piñon, the National Wildlife Federation, NWF's monarch recovery strategist, monarch butterflies generally only live 28 to 32 days, but the generation that migrates is different. Sometimes dubbed the super or Matusalem generation, these monarchs live from 6 to 9 months and will live throughout the entire migration during winter, and on the first leg of the migration north the following spring. They won't die until after they fly north in March and lay eggs on the first milkweed they find, most likely somewhere in Texas. In contrast, the subsequent generations that migrate back north during spring and summer will live typically brief lives, mating and dying as their offspring continue the journey. It'll take about 3 generations for the monarchs to return to their summer breeding grounds. How such a tiny insect can fly such a long distance and how its lifespan can be vastly longer than its immediate progenitors is one of the fascinations of science. That's the miracle of the monarchs, says Mary Phillips, head of the NWF's Garden for Wildlife and Certified Wildlife Habitat Programs. The miracle, she says, is that the monarch's migratory behavior somehow seems to be passed down through their genes, and it guides these little insects on their spectacular fall journey. This is the only insect known to have a two-way migration, says Quiñones Piñon. The same individuals that migrate in the fall overwinter for 4 to 5 months and then migrate back north in the spring. Trouble ahead. The fall migration for both the eastern and western populations is critical to scientists because that's when they count or estimate the numbers in the overwintering grounds to gauge the success of the migration and the health of the species. In Mexico, scientists arrive at those numbers by estimating the numbers of butterflies per hectare of forest. In the 1990s, the eastern population of monarch butterflies numbered almost 700 million, while their population today has been drastically reduced by about 80%. This year's annual survey of the eastern monarch population by the World Wildlife Fund in Mexico indicates that the monarch's long-term downward trajectory is continuing. During the winter of 2022-23, the butterflies occupied an estimated 2.21 hectares of forest, a decline of approximately 22% compared with the previous winter, when monarchs occupied 2.84 hectares. The monarch butterfly was put on the International Union for Conservation of Nature, IUCN, endangered species list in 2022. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has placed monarchs as a candidate for consideration on the official U.S. endangered species list, with a final decision coming during the 2024 fiscal year. The current five-year population average from 2018 to 2022 is less than 50% of the 6-hectare recovery goal laid out in the Mid-America Monarch Conservation Strategy, adds Quiñones Piñon. The monarch butterfly population is in decline because of a number of factors. A major one is the loss of milkweed and nectar-producing plants in the central U.S., as well as the degradation of native habitat stopover areas in the south-central states. Monarch butterflies are also impacted by insecticides and the climate crisis, which Phillips says may also affect migration flight patterns. The monarch's peril isn't limited to the iconic insect. The monarch butterfly is a sentinel species whose health and condition mirrors many other wildlife populations, especially pollinators, explains Quiñones Piñon. These continuing low population numbers are a warning sign that cannot be overstated. Protecting monarchs. These declining population numbers are also a call to action. That's where home gardeners come in. Fall gardens are as critical to stopping the decline of monarchs as spring and summer gardens. The generation flying south to Mexico is going to need a ton of nectar, says Phillips. That's why home gardeners need to plant asters, goldenrods, liatris, echinacea, coreopsis, rudbeckia, and other flowers that bloom late summer and into the fall to provide nectar to fuel this phase of the journey. Consider planting milkweed and nectar-producing flowers that are native to your area to give the plants the greatest chance to thrive and to benefit monarchs. Milkweed not only provides nectar to adult monarchs, but it's also the only plant monarch caterpillars can eat since the plant and butterfly species have co-evolved together. The toxic carotenoids in milkweed generally protect the caterpillars from predators, though the monarch eggs and caterpillars are vulnerable to predators such as praying mantis, parasitic flies, and wasps. Some predators have developed a tolerance or learned to minimize their exposure when eating the adult butterflies. Black-backed orioles avoid the toxin-rich cuticle of the monarch's abdomen by cutting them open before eating them. Black-headed grosbeaks can eat large quantities of monarchs without getting poisoned, says Quiñones Piñon. Grosbeaks somehow can tolerate higher levels of carotenoids, and eat the monarch's whole abdomen. Two native milkweeds popular with home gardeners that can be planted in many areas are the pink-flowering swamp milkweed, Asclepias incarnata, and butterfly weed, Asclepias tuberosa, which has brilliant orange flowers. Avoid planting the non-native tropical milkweed, Asclepias curassavica. According to Quinones Piñon, the presence of tropical milkweed can cause migrating monarchs to mate and then linger in place instead of continuing the journey. Furthermore, they may mate with their offspring, which can result in birth defects for the next generation. Deeply interconnected. Monarchs are a topic of conservation interest and cultural intrigue in their migratory path as they fly toward Mexico. Monarch enthusiasts anticipate their arrival at wildlife refuges where they stop to rest and refuel in natural places. These sites include the Neil Smith National Wildlife Refuge in Iowa, the Quivira National Wildlife Refuge in Kansas, the John Hines National Wildlife Refuge in Pennsylvania, the Eastern Shore of Virginia National Wildlife Refuge, the St. Marks National Wildlife Refuge in Florida, and the Balcones Canyonlands National Wildlife Refuge in Texas. Nowhere, though, is their arrival awaited with greater anticipation than in Mexico. To add to the mystique of the monarch, their fall migration concludes when they arrive in Mexico, coinciding with one of the most significant events in Mexican culture, Dia de Muertos, or Day of the Dead, from November 1 to November 2. According to Quinones Piñon, many people in Mexico believe in the pre-Hispanic legend that the returning butterflies carry with them the souls of ancestors from the afterlife. The connection between our traditions, culture, and the monarch butterfly is a great opportunity to uplift our efforts to conserve and protect the butterfly, writes Quinones Piñon. Now deeply rooted in our traditions, the monarch deserves that we take care of its habitats, that we advocate and speak for it, and that we ask others to help us conserve this amazing creature that has contributed to our lives in so many ways. The deep emotional connection that many of us have with the monarch might be beyond words, and it makes us care for its survival as a species. Becky Griffin seconds Quinones Piñon's thoughts. Griffin, the coordinator for the Great Southeast Pollinator Census, was in the Biosphere Reserve in February with a group of scientists and photographers on a trip organized by Monarchs Across Georgia, a monarch conservation group. There are no words to describe observing the butterflies in their overwintering grounds, says Griffin. I've tried magical, otherworldly, spiritual. Her voice trails off and a loss for further words. While there, the group visited a school in the town of Angangui, and asked the children about loss of habitat in the overwintering forests. Finally, one sixth grade girl, sounding frustrated, stood up and said, "We're seeing less and less butterflies here every year. What are you people doing up there to save them?" That made the hair on the back of my neck stand up, recalls Griffin. It's all we talked about on the trip home. Helping monarchs. Let's all do what we can to preserve these magnificent creatures for future generations. The home gardener can help counteract this decline by planting native milkweed and nectar-rich plants for migrating monarchs. Together, we can make sure that these incredible creatures continue their fascinating journey year after year. Tom Oder is an independent journalist living in Atlanta, Georgia. He writes about gardening, the environment, and agribusiness. Here's a small inset article called Milkweed, Seeds or Seedlings. There are two approaches to introducing milkweed plants to your garden. One is to grow the plants from seed. The other is to start with seedlings from plant nurseries. There's not a right or wrong answer. You just have to ask yourself, what's right for me? Here's a guide to help answer that question. Germinating milkweed seeds. Germinating milkweed seeds and raising the tender seedlings requires patience, time, and even a little luck. You'll need to mimic the process of how milkweeds germinate in nature. Depending on where you live, you'll have to create winter-like conditions, and this can be difficult if you're trying to germinate seeds in a warm season. But it can be done if you're up for the challenge. Germinating milkweed seeds isn't like when you were back in elementary school and stuck a bean in a cup and came back a few weeks later and you had this tall plant, says Shubber Alley, CEO of Garden for Wildlife, an online native plant business in which a portion of proceeds benefit the NWF's National Conservation Habitat Education Program. The first step is selecting seeds of milkweeds that are native to your region. Obtain seeds from a reputable source and as locally as possible to ensure good germination rates and healthy plants. Germinating the seeds will be dependent on your location. Germination instructions vary based on location. Most milkweed seeds will need some form of cold stratification. Milkweed seeds can be directly sown in fall or early spring or placed in the refrigerator for at least 30 days to simulate winter. Some species of milkweed will need longer. Some people put the seeds in wet sand or potting soil when they cold stratify milkweed seeds in the refrigerator, while others wrap them in moist paper towels. That sort of works, says Allie, who has also tried the paper towel method with mixed results. But it's not the same as the freezing and expanding that takes place outdoors that cracks the shell coat, which helps with germination. You're trying to mimic that. Seedlings. Starting off with seedlings in small pots is an excellent approach for those who don't have the time or inclination to grow milkweed from seed. Carefully tend to your seedlings for weeks, either outdoors or indoors, depending on your location, and harden them off before planting in your garden. Garden for Wildlife offers milkweed and other native plant collections for your regional area based on your zip code. From there, you can filter for light conditions, soil moisture, plant height, wildlife benefit, and other characteristics. So far, it's contracted with native plant wholesalers in 38 states with plans to scale up. We're making a difference, says Ali, even for people in an apartment with one planter. Ali wants people to put milkweed and other native plants in the ground. Then I want them to tell somebody else to put a plant in the ground, and that will start to change people. I think we have one other inset real quick here. Watching out for Western monarchs. The Western population of monarch butterflies journey south and fall for about 300 miles from as far as the southern region of the Canadian province of British Columbia to overwinter near the Pacific coast, ranging from Marin County to Baja California, Mexico. In the 1980s, the Western population was more than a million, and it now has severely declined by 99%, according to the Xerces Society. In the Xerces Society's 2022 Western Monarch Thanksgiving count, 335,479 butterflies were sighted, compared with 247,237 in 2021. However, the California groves, where overwintering monarchs cluster in 200 to 300 small colonies, suffered extensive tree loss from winter storms after the Thanksgiving count. The storms forced these monarchs to search for new shelter. No one knows yet what the consequences of those storms will be. It's clear that extreme weather events such as California's latest winter extreme rainfalls show the devastating impacts of the climate crisis on the butterfly, says Quiñones Piñon. Joint efforts to reverse the Western monarch decline should be steady, long-term, and primarily focused on restoring and conserving their breeding and overwintering native habitats through effective climate adaptation strategies. Climate change has its own agenda, and we must counteract it fiercely to protect the monarch and its incredible migration. Two very long kind of articles, but very interesting, even if I did butcher some of the words, and I apologize for that. We have reached the end of our time together. You have been listening to another episode of Natural Life. I'm Kim McCurdy, as always. Thank you for listening.